You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. On today's show, we're going to be speaking to Rachel Kleinfeld, author of a new book called A Savage Order. It's about violence and how some people and their governments have significantly reduced epidemic levels of violence where they live. Now, I read a lot of books, but it's rare that I find one so powerful, and I just want to say important, because it addresses what I feel, and I'm guessing a lot of people feel, about the kinds of violence that happen outside of war. Gangs and organized crime, and sometimes even the police themselves. One feels fear, despair, cynicism, and powerlessness in the face of this kind of violence, especially when the authorities are either ineffective against the violence or are actually colluding with it. And so I'm reading this book, and here's a profound study of the causes of violence, which aren't always what you might think, and how actual people have forged peace. We will be talking to Rachel Kleinfeld right after this break. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation strengthens education in northern New Mexico so that learners of all ages can reach their full potential, offering grants that fund public education and community projects, building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood programs, providing K-12 wraparound services for students and teachers with Inquiry Science as the flagship initiative, investing in students' dreams through scholarships, and creating a solid foundation for learning and systemic change through partnership and advocacy. For program information or to give, visit lanlfoundation.org. I'm very happy to welcome Rachel Kleinfeld. She's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she's author of the new book, A Savage Order: How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. She will be speaking on Thursday, February 7th at 5:30 at the Hotel Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Nice to see you. This is an amazing book. I've been reading it with incredible interest. And I wanted to, before we start talking about the book, I wanted to kind of ask you, how is it that you came to devote so much of your life to the study of violence?
That's an interesting question. I was working in New Haven, Connecticut, in the height of the last wave of violence in America in the early 90s, when Connecticut's rates of violence and maternal mortality and all sorts of things were really a piece with the developing world. And I thought, how can this exist in America? And then I sent myself overseas. I went to work in India for a while and saw some horrific acts of violence that really held back development and human potential. And back then, nobody was talking about violence. If you worked in human rights, if you worked in international development, it was all about poverty. It was all about rights from the state. But no one was really talking about violence from your fellow man or woman.
Right, right. And you grew up in Alaska, which was what? Kind of a violent place?
Yeah, actually, when I was growing up, it was an extremely violent place. When I was a kid, I think I faced the wrong end of a rifle three or four times at least before the time I got to college. Everybody was armed. Trespassing was not recommended. It was a frontier.
So now we're living in a world which is significantly less violent than it was even 30 years ago, much less a few hundred years ago. And violence is way down from war in comparison to non-war deaths, which is what your book is about. Things like mafias and gang killings and organized crime and governments killing their own people, not to mention regular homicide. It might be hard for some listeners to believe that the world is less violent than it's ever been. Explain what's going on.
So it was hard for me to believe. When I started this book, I had read Steven Pinker's book about the Better Angels of Our Nature, which claims that violence is going down and has been going down for centuries. I was so skeptical that, first of all, I'm on record on a podcast saying I didn't believe the book. And then I went back and read all his original research. And then I still didn't believe what they were coming up with. And so I went back to the original numbers, and then I called the original researchers. At the end of all that, I believed that they were telling the truth, which is this amazing story that we're not hearing much in the media because, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. People want to hear the stories of violence and mayhem, and they make good pictures. But the reality is that war deaths are precipitously down since the end of the Cold War and even before that. we now have 90% of war deaths that don't exist because people are have learned how to do better battlefield medicine. War is different. Now, you know, we hear about it in the Ukraine. If a platoon faces off against a unit and three men die, we hear about it. In World War II, 20,000 people would die on the same day. And you'd hear about it. It was one day's news story. So think about how many three deaths need to trickle down to make 20,000. That's what's going on now. We hear about every single thing that it used to be we either didn't hear about at all or they happened very suddenly. And so murders are down. In the U.S., we're almost at 1950s levels of murders. So we hear these horrible stories of police brutality and so on. It's happening. I'm not saying it's not happening. But in 1971, in New York City alone, cops were killing someone in the line of duty every 4 days. We're nothing like that now. So our set point has changed. What we're willing to put up with has changed a lot.
Which is not a bad thing.
Which is a great thing. I think it's really wonderful. And it's actually one of the hopeful parts of this book was that it's kind of a last mile problem. We're dealing with the parts of violent death that still exist, but it's a much, much smaller problem now.
There are a lot of explanations for the roots of violence. For example, violence is the result of poverty or Islamic fundamentalism or religion itself or race or quote-unquote ancient ethnic hatreds. Are those things, in fact, root causes?
So I went through this. You know, one of the interesting things of writing a book when you aren't sure of your answer beforehand is that you really get to investigate. And so I investigated each of these things, and I found that actually the two most populous Islamic countries, which are India and Indonesia, send almost no one to jihad. Very low rates of murder. In Indonesia, it's 1 per 100,000, which is like the lowest rates in Europe. In India, it's about 3 per 100,000, which is still much, much less than the United States. We're at 5 per 100,000. So these are very peaceful societies. It's hard to say Islam is the problem when your two biggest Islamic countries in the world are actually quite peaceful and aren't sending people to jihad. And when I spoke with and researched the literature on Islam, what it looks like is that actually the fundamentalists are recruiting people who are already violent. So they're recruiting in prisons people who are already violent, transforming them into Islamists, often converting them from whatever they were before. And then those people can take those violent impulses and suddenly cloak them in a rationale that makes sense to them. And in Islamic countries, what you're seeing is it's not all Islamic countries. It's the repressive countries. It's the ones where the governments have really cracked down on any other method of voice where you're getting a lot of terrorism. So I decided it wasn't Islam. And I went through each of the sort of major categories. Poverty, you said, is a common cause of violence. And it's true that places that are poor often fall into war. But homicide is actually much more of a middle-income country problem. South Africa and Africa, Nigeria, those are two of the richest countries in Africa. Those are the ones with the big homicide issue. Same in Latin America, Brazil, places that have enough money for opera houses and lots of other nice accoutrements.
But they have inequality.
That's right. And that was one of the keys to the book. It's not about your overall level of wealth or poverty. That doesn't cause violence. Poor people aren't necessarily violent for any reason. And there's no reason to think that if you suddenly become poor, you'll become violent. In fact, violence tends to go up during economic booms, not busts. But inequality is highly, highly correlated with violence. And one of the things I wanted to find out was why.
So you've coined the term privilege violence. What does that mean? And give us some examples.
So I was going to various different countries all over the world. I picked two countries in each continent, basically, one that had become very violent and got better and one that hadn't gotten better, to try to figure out what was going on. And the ones that got better, how did they do that and why? And I thought I was going to write a typical think tank book, you know, lots of little stories about lots of little problems and how they got better and what we could do about it and the policies. But I kept seeing the same themes recurring in each of the cases I was going to. And then I had a historical case. I wanted to look at the United States after the end of the Civil War here. We had just had a Civil War. There were roving bands of criminals all over. There was a very weak state. The Wild West was wild. You know, we all know the gunslinger stories. But we often don't hear about the violence in the South. And I was interested in why did the Wild West get better so quickly, actually? 30 years or so, the Wild West transformed to pretty normal rates of violence.
At the end of the 19th century.
Right, in the 1880s, 1890s. But the South got more and more violent. By 1892, so now we're talking almost 30 years after the end of the Civil War, you had somebody being lynched in the South every 36 hours. and I wanted to know why the different trajectories. And that turned out to be the key to what I ended up calling privilege violence, and it tied the stories together. And it basically was a system in which you're a democracy in name, but in reality, the country or the place or the region is basically an oligarchy. There's a wealthy, small class of people who want to rule, and they don't think they can rule legitimately if democratic elections are true and honest. And in this case, of course, African Americans were enfranchised, and the old Confederate leadership thought, there's no way we're going to win an election. And so what they do is they enable and allow and stoke societal violence. So in the South, it was the KKK and about 20 other groups that are known as Knight Rider groups, you know, all the white supremacist groups that were running around the South. They would hurt African Americans, but they also hurt Republicans. And those were often overlapping groups because African Americans flocked to the party of Lincoln after the end of the Civil War.
And just for our listeners, Republicans at that time are not the same as Republicans today.
Sadly, that is the case.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Republicans at that time, it was the party of Lincoln. It was highly
abolitionist.
Abolitionist and for equality and so on. There was a lot of corruption still in both parties. But so the Knight Rider groups were targeting African Americans and Republicans, and the old Confederate leadership thought, you know, this could help us. And so they weren't causing the violence themselves, but they were stoking it, they were encouraging it with their language. And as they gained power, they would give impunity to those groups and allow them to keep on doing what they were doing, and nobody could be jailed for murdering a black man, for instance, in the South. There's all sorts of quotes in the book about how there was no justice if you killed someone who was African American. That allowed them to get back into power, and a decade after the Civil War, the old Confederacy was back in power in almost every state.
You write about how lynchings were not only acts of racial hatred, which they were, but also political acts in the sense that there would be lynchings right before elections to discourage people from voting.
That's right. And I think, you know, we don't learn Reconstruction in school in America. At least I didn't. And I think a lot of people don't. It's a part of our history we've sort of buried. But when I looked at what was going on here during those years, it sure looked a lot like what's going on in Myanmar right now with the murders of the pogroms against the Rohingya Muslims, or I'm Jewish, in Russia in the early 1900s. You had pogroms against Jews. And they all follow the same pattern, which is, it's not that the politicians are causing the killing necessarily. They're stoking it with their language. But what they're doing is giving impunity afterward. And so everyone knows that they can get away with it, and it allows it to increase. And so they'd stoke it with their words before elections. Lynchings would skyrocket, and it would scare the voters on the opposition side from voting, and the old Dixiecrats could win their seats again.
You're making a really important distinction, which is something that I hadn't really thought about before I read this book, which is the difference between a weak state and a complicit state. So in the Wild West, you had a weak state where there just weren't the sheriffs, the government, the institutions, the structures to enforce laws. In the South, the institutions were fine, but they were complicit and corrupt and violent.
That's right. And I think this is a distinction that is lost on an awful lot of people, including the U.S. government, quite frequently. We have this idea among policymakers that if a democracy is overrun by violence, Mexico, Central America, you know, a lot of democracies that we have right on our border, they must not be able to fight. And so you hear stories about, oh, this country is overrun by gangs, let's send them security aid, let's teach them how to fight, let's give them equipment so that they can fight back. And it rarely occurs to the policymakers that the politicians might be gaining something from that violence. It might be helping them stay in power. They might be gaining money from drug cartels. They might be gaining election money for their campaigns. And that's what I found. In these cases where democracies are extraordinarily violent, a very few are weak, are true weak states like our Wild West, but most are complicit.
One of the states that you write about in the book that was weak was Sicily. Because Sicily had been conquered so many times, mm-hmm. and then they found they had a big cash crop, which was lemons, and they didn't have a strong government, and suddenly there was a big influx of money. Is that like a formula for corruption?
Yes, and I should say that many of the states that are complicit have become weak, and they become weak because they're deliberately weakened, or they start off weak and then they never are allowed to get strong, and Sicily is a perfect case of that. So Sicily was a weak state because Italy was a weak state. It took decades for Italy to really consolidate. It was a bunch of different city-states owned by different empires in the late 1800s. It took a long time for them to come together, and Sicily was the same, full of crime and the kind of violence that happens during wartime. But suddenly, America and Europe discovered they loved lemons, and Sicily happened to grow a lot of lemons. And so the area right around Palermo, the capital of Sicily, was known as the sort of bowl of lemons, bowl of gold, they called it. What happened was that the landlords of this weak state invited guards to watch their lemon groves. It was worth a ton of money. They needed guards. The guards knew that the best way to prevent theft was to actually work with the criminals. And so they would all form their own gangs, and they would work in league with the criminals. And that way, if a criminal did steal their lemons, they had a gang that could go after that criminal group. And so they all became sort of criminal groups. And that was the origins of the mafia, it turned out. And those landowners gained protection from the new democracy. As the democracy grew, the political parties courted the landowners for money, and then for campaign money, and then offered in exchange that they could have their private military groups, which is what they basically were. So the mafia formed, and then the mafia offered help to the government. The mafia said, hey, we can help drum down opposition voting at voting time, and we can make sure that everyone under our control or whom we could threaten will vote for you. And so then Sicily never got stronger. What happened was a kind of constant weak state because of that deal between the Christian Democratic Party, the landowners, and the mafia, the nascent mafia. And you could see, I read a report from over 100 years ago, and it read just like the mafia trials in the 1990s. The whole thing was laid out in the late 1800s, but they couldn't do anything about it because it was in league with the party that controlled the island for so long.
In the book, you talk about the origins of the word privilege, as in the term privilege violence. Privis is private, legis is law, privilege, basically private law. And so it really sort of puts into focus, I mean, the mafia have their own, practically their own armies, their own security system, their own, that, you know, when you buy legislatures, you own the law in some way. So that leads to a process that you call decivilization. And we're seeing that, for example, in Central America. We saw that in Colombia. Describe what you mean by decivilization.
Sure. So first, I'm at pains in the book to make clear that it's not that any kind of person is decivilized or any particular culture. It can happen anywhere. And it happens when a certain set of circumstances take place. The first is that the government or the politicians decide that they will partner with these violent groups for campaign contributions, for help quelling opposition voters, what have you. They then politicize their security institutions so that if one of those violent groups that they've promised impunity to gets arrested, they can say, hey, you've got to let that person off. So the security institutions become politicized. That means that you don't get ahead on merit, you get ahead on political connections. It means the budget is highly political, and they usually keep the budget very low so that the security institutions have to come begging for gas to get their cars where they need to go, or basic things. So they're dependent on the politicians. And that weakens the security services. And that means that good people tend to leave and they find other jobs. And the people who stay in the security services are the people who desperately need that job. And then the government incentivizes repression for various reasons. And you can see this right now in Central America, where the vice president of El Salvador says to the police, if you kill gang members, you won't go to jail, quite explicitly. The new president of Brazil has said similar things. When he was head of Rio de Janeiro, 1 in 5 killings in that city was a policeman killing someone in the line of duty. So 20% of all killings were from the state.
And they were incentivized to do that.
They're incentivized to do that. And they're incentivized for various reasons. Basically, it helps the government say that they're being tough on crime, so they can sell themselves to your middle-class voters by saying, look, I'm being tough on crime. We're going to do zero tolerance, 3 strikes and you're out, death squads in certain places. And it also allows the government to kill people that they would rather not have around under the guise of just general societal violence. So when I started the book, we mapped journalist murders against weak states. And what we found was that journalists don't get murdered in weak states at all. There's a handful, 2 or 3 outliers, but you see the strong clump in states that are quite able but don't want journalists to be investigating certain things. So in Mexico, for instance, where it's one of the most dangerous countries in the world for journalists, the ones that are killed are not those that are investigating the cartels. They're actually the local journalists investigating government corruption who get killed. So under the cover of lots of social violence and in general sort of violent society, the government can do away through its security services accidentally killing people, supposedly accidentally, people they don't want. Well, what happens? The middle class buys security. The middle class starts buying private guards. They live in bulletproof houses. They live in gated communities. And you see that throughout Central America, for instance. Private security outnumber police in every Spanish-speaking country. The poor can't buy private security. So what do the poor do? They're left to try to protect themselves. And so organized criminals and gangs come in, and vigilante groups come in, and they say, we'll protect you against the other gangs and against the other drug cartels for a price. And so it's an extortionate relationship. But it's basically all that the poor have because the government's being predatory upon them. And what happens in that kind of milieu is that people's inhibitions to using violence lower. It's so ubiquitous. There's so much impunity. In many of these countries that I'm looking at, it's well over 90% of people get away with murder. So it becomes something that ordinary people can conceive of to do away with an ex-spouse that they don't like, a business rival, a neighbor who's encroaching on their land. So it becomes something that's not just professional killers, but is actually everyday people. And we see that in bloody Kansas and bloody Missouri on the edge of the Civil War when those two states sort of devolved into neighbor upon neighbor murder. And we saw it in Colombia and in all the countries that I looked at, this kind of everyday violence creating extraordinary numbers of homicides among regular people.
And that points to something else that you write about in the book, that it was another distinction that I hadn't made, which is there's a difference between what somebody might call a violent culture and corrupt institutions. And the kind of violence you're talking about, you know, neighbors killing neighbors, or a kind of almost like trickle-down violence from all the violence around you, that's not really a violent culture. And it can be changed very quickly when the institutions change.
That's right. Actually, the most memorable interview I did lots of interviews with warlords and journalists and activists all over the world for this book. The best, I think, was with the man who was ambassador to the Republic of Georgia. And he's a huge man. He looks like a bear. And he sat across from me and I said, you know, Georgia cleaned up its corruption in one generation, and it was corruption that people said had gone back over 100 years and was deep in the Georgian psyche. And he said, what we proved was that corruption as a cultural issue was bullshit. It's like the Japanese watermelons. And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean the Japanese watermelons? I was there with my research assistant and we both looked at each other. And he said, it's like the square Japanese watermelons. And what he meant was that in Japan, there's a cultural predilection for square watermelons. They like to give them as gifts. But watermelons don't grow square. And so they grow them in square pots so that they will come out square and they can give them as gifts. And he was saying, look, there might be a cultural predilection toward violence. Some cultures might have more of a desire to use violence, but they only get away with that if you give them the square pots, basically, if you create institutions that allow and incentivize that violence. And if you do the opposite, then you won't get that kind of violence.
One of the things that is apparently central to lowering violence is getting the middle class engaged. And sometimes the middle class, as you say, are complicit. They're buying private security. They're voting for strongman law and order candidates and so on. But there are some examples of places where the middle class got off its butt, got involved to combat the violence and the corruption that was all around them, instead of either being complicit or just sort of being asleep and doing their own thing.
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't want to blame the middle class too much. I mean, we can look at our own society. These are highly unequal societies. And one of the things that happens when places are highly unequal is that it's really easy to ignore what's happening to people who seem different than you. And one thing that the middle class often does in these countries is say, oh, yes, there's a lot of homicide, there's a lot of violence, but it's criminals killing criminals. It's not regular people, it's not civilians, as they often say. And so they can write it off, or they can say it's people who look different, different race, different level of poverty, what have you. I mean, look right here in New Mexico and Albuquerque. Who among us is out there protesting in the street about the levels of violence in Albuquerque? But it's pretty bad. And so it's like that in a lot of these places, and the violence has to start touching the middle class and making them feel that that it could happen to anyone, that it's not just criminals killing criminals, it's not just people who are darker or poorer or what have you, but it's hitting them too. and then they will get off their butts and do something. But they have a choice at that point. Can they do something that makes their society more inclusive, that makes it more equitable for everyone, and that gets police to do their jobs for the poor as well as the middle class? Or do they vote for more repression? And it turns out it's much easier to vote for more repression, to vote for stronger jail sentences, three strikes and you're out policies, more money to the police, that kind of thing, and not to necessarily care about the rest of the society. And so they need social organizers to basically help the middle class understand that this is a problem of their government. It's not a problem of just criminals killing criminals.
And it turns out that repression doesn't even really work in the long run to combat violence.
That's right. So I wanted to look at that because, you know, I'm a researcher, and if it does work, it's worth exploring. I started out life as a human rights activist, and so I didn't want to find out that repression helped, but I was willing to look at it if it did. And so I looked at it in two different ways. I first looked at it globally, because everyone kept telling me when I told them I was looking at a book of countries that beat violence, they said, oh, are you doing a chronicle of Rwanda? And so I did do a study of Rwanda, and what I found in Rwanda is what I found in most of the international cases, which was Rwanda's genocide was horrible. Before that, they had a civil war. They had a long history of violence. They had a strong man come in who basically stopped the genocide, stopped the violence, and instituted an autocracy in Rwanda. And it's very clean, and it's very orderly, and it's very, very autocratic. And that did stop the violence in Rwanda. But what it did was that it pushed the violence into neighboring countries as they pursued wars in the Congo, as they took minerals and so on from rebel groups there. And so far, far more people have died in the neighboring countries with wars that have been stoked and helped along by the government of Rwanda. So one thing I saw was that autocracies were really good at quelling violence internally, but they tended to export the violence elsewhere. Same with terrorism, most of which comes from autocratic countries. So it doesn't, it only works if you look only at a small unit, just this, the country itself. And then I looked at policing. Does more repressive policing actually help solve violence? And in fact, it backfires astronomically. And all the researchers know this, but it's still a very easy political sell. So basically what happens when you institute a policy where you throw a lot of people in jail really quickly is that you don't have a lot of extra jails around, and so the jails become crowded, they become smelly, things stop breaking, you know, the showers aren't working, that kind of thing. And who has power in jails? It's the gangs. In every country, in our own country too, the gangs have power. And so if you're pretty sure as a young man that you're going to get rounded up and thrown in jail, whether you're a gang member or not, because of one of these three strikes and you're out kind of policies or zero tolerance policies, it behooves you to get close to the gang members, because that's how you're going to get protected in jail. And so the gangs get much stronger, and they learn from each other in jail, and they learn from older organized criminals in jail. And so what you see in every country that's instituted this is much stronger gangs, the gangs that control the street when they're in jail. And also what you see is the criminals lowering who does the worst crimes. So you see crime being pushed down to younger and younger kids who are below the age of criminal responsibility, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. And you start getting massive numbers of young kids thrown into adult jails. And one thing we know about that is that that really sends those kids into a life of crime. Kids who were maybe a little bit on the wrong path often go straight. More than 50% of juvenile delinquents just go straight naturally as they grow up. But the ones who go to adult jails tend not to. They stick with the life of crime. So it actually kind of metastasizes all the crime to do that kind of repression.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take a quick break. Please stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation supports education along the cradle to career spectrum by investing in Northern New Mexico school districts, nonprofit education programs, and community projects. Education and community grants of up to $2,500 are available to qualified education programs that serve the counties of Los Alamos, Mora, Rio Arriba, San Miguel, Sandoval, Santa Fe, or Taos. 2019 grant application deadlines are February 15th and August 15th. For more information or to apply, visit lanlfoundation.org/grants. That's lanlfoundation.org/grants. And now back to our program. Let's go back to the process by which violence is actually reduced. And I think one of the things that's really interesting about this, first of all, it requires middle class engagement. And sometimes there has to be a precipitating event, like in Sicily, two prosecutors were assassinated. They were both people that middle class Sicilians could identify with, and people took to the streets. So there's that whole process. But then in order for there to be institutional change, one of the things that politicians have to do is they have to make deals with, essentially they have to negotiate with terrorists, which right-wing people don't like. And they have to basically give them a certain amount of amnesty, which left-wing people don't like. It's sort of a, you kind of alienate your citizenry to some extent when you make these deals, but they're necessary. Why are they necessary?
So in any state that's caught in privileged violence, the security services have been deliberately weakened. They've been politicized. Their budgets have been cut, so they're dependent on the politicians and so on. So they're generally very weak and very corrupt. So say the middle class is helped by social organizers to elect a politician who promises to create a society that's fairer, to actually make the police work, to stop the crime. And that politician wants to do that in a real way. What do they have at their disposal? They get into office and they've got this incredibly corrupt, broken police system. Maybe the military is a little better, but militaries aren't taught to do policing techniques. And so whenever you put militaries on the street, they tend to commit a lot of human rights abuses and so on. It's just a different training. They're not meant to do civilian policing. And so what are they supposed to do? And it turns out it's really hard. What they first have to do is make deals with the violent groups, because the state is just too weak to fight them to a standstill. And those deals, I call them dirty deals in the book, because sometimes they're peace negotiations, sometimes they're deals with criminals, cartels, paramilitaries, but they're basically offering a lot of impunity, because why else would the violent group put down its arms if the state is too weak to do anything? So they tend to allow impunity, they tend to allow corruption, and they're not popular. They do work, but if they're allowed to stand, the violence comes back, because you've just allowed corrupt, violent people to have a place in your society. And so there's this kind of Texas two-step of offering the deals, but then very quickly creating a strong and more fair state, so that the citizenry believe that you're trying to create a fair state, and so that the police and so on get strong enough to prosecute the violent groups over time. You can't let those dirty deals stick, but you have to make them.
And so you make them, that buys you a window of opportunity, which is several years long. And then in that time, you have to kind of race to build your institutions and build them in a non-corrupt way. And that's hard. I mean, you have a society which is, as you call it, decivilized. Now you're re-civilizing. It's sort of like it's easy to knock down a house. It's harder to build a new one. What are the necessary conditions of that process, and what are the pitfalls along the way?
So I found it was two things, and it was one of those, the left wing was right and the right wing was right, and that you needed both of them. That what you needed was a politician who, through clear symbolic acts that everybody could cite, was clearly reaching out to all the citizenry, was governing for all the citizenry. And so they would do things like in Medellin, the new mayor who was doing this kind of inclusive growth, he held a concert series all over town, including in bad parts of town. And so people from good parts of town would go to the worst neighborhoods to hear concerts that they wanted to hear. He put Christmas lights along the river, which was a place where there was a lot of homicides, but it was also a beautiful river running through the middle of town, so that people would go to the river and see the Christmas lights and become part of a community. He built gondolas, which are like skiing gondolas, that went up the hills where the slums were, so that as a big symbolic act, he was connecting the slums to the subway system so that people wouldn't have hours and hours of walking to get where they were going. And a lot of that was symbolic. It wasn't real in terms of changing people's lives, but it was something everybody could see. They could touch it. It was concrete. And then they needed to do the things that changed people's lives: more money to education, more money for policing in poor areas, which tend to be both under and over policed. They don't get good policing, they get brutal policing, and what they want is a happy medium. So they have to do all these inclusive actions, but they also have to prosecute the violence, because society's self-police. Most crime is not committed because most people don't want to commit crime. If everyone was out there just waiting for their chance to kill someone, no state could deal with that situation. You need just a few people to be committing most of the crime for a state to be able to keep a lid on things. And in a healthy society, that's how it works. So societies need to self-police. They can't do that if the state isn't doing its job because they're too scared to come forward and tell, you know, say you've got a drug dealer on your stoop who's smoking and you don't want that drug dealer smoking on your stoop. Are you going to tell the drug dealer, hey, don't smoke on my stoop if you think that drug dealer is going to go kill you? No, obviously not. But you will if you think the state will protect you. So the state has to both be inclusive, but it also has to start really policing and really putting the right people in jail, not everybody, not a blanket repression, but actually going after the most violent people in society.
Which turns out to be a pretty tiny percentage of people most of the time.
That's right. It's one of the things that we know about policing. We call it hotspot policing. And we also know that a very small percentage of people commit most of the crimes in a very small number of places. So if you put more police in those small number of places, and if you target the most violent, some cities it's the most violent 20 people, some of the cities it's the most violent 50 people, it's a really small number.
So in the process of building institutions, even if you don't have full-on authoritarianism, some of the elements that you write about as being necessary to combat violence and to keep it at bay and to build a more stable state are things that many ordinary people are very skeptical of. Centralization of power, surveillance, asset seizure, the government having a monopoly on violence. Those are things that are, first of all, incredibly ripe for corruption, and we see that all around us in this country, much less in other countries. They run counter to many of our deepest values, like privacy, property rights, in this country, gun ownership, and distribution of power. I mean, people are very skeptical of any one group having too much power. So why are they such essential parts of the solution, and how can they be safeguarded against corruption, if they even can?
So this, I think of it as sort of a book for grown-ups, in that this is not a simple book, and the answers aren't simple. Everything is a little gray. And fighting violence when you've had these extremely violent societies requires a lot of work in this gray, murky zone. And so what I found was that when you have privileged violence, the problem is politicians that are complicit with violent groups, whether it's Southern politicians in the Klan or Colombian politicians in the paramilitaries or what have you. The only way to go after organized crime, which is what that is, crime that has tentacles into government, is to use surveillance because they can kill witnesses. And so you need to get information in some other way. And you need intelligence, you need informants, because these are groups in which the top people don't commit the crimes. The top people keep their hands clean. So all you'll get are the low-level people, unless you can turn some of those low-level people to find out who's ordering the killings, who's at the top of the heap. And you need asset seizure. Now, not the kind of civil asset seizure that's being abused in America, I should be really clear, and the book tries to be really clear about it, but criminal asset seizure, someone who's charged with a crime. You need to seize those assets because, as I was told in Palermo when I was talking to, in Sicily, when I was talking to one of the top prosecutors of the mafia, if they go to jail, they expect that. They have whole systems to help with the elderly parents and the wives and the children and so on. But if their assets are threatened, they bring four lawyers. They really, really don't want you to take away their money because that's their power. And so you need those things to break organized crime that has its tentacles into government. But are they dangerous? Absolutely. And in almost every case, governments that used these tools to break the organized crime and to break the ties of violence with the government then started to move toward repression. And so what you needed was a really active citizenry that said, wait, wait, we liked this for the first year of your term, and now we don't like this, and now you need to stop, and they need to vote these people out. And so when I was talking last week, I was in Washington, D.C., giving a talk on Capitol Hill about the book, and I said, look, one of the lessons of the book is that when you find a reformer, in quotes, you have to be sure that that person is monitored because they won't stay a reformer for long. All these people are kind of Jekyll and Hyde, and you need to make sure money is still flowing to all the civilian watchdog groups and accountability groups and anti-corruption groups so that as they start to turn and get a little too headstrong about those powers, they can be checked by an active citizenry.
And that's one of the lessons of the book, is that citizens have to be engaged even as government enacts reforms. It's like, I think you called it two wheels of the cart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not my line. That's actually the mayor of Palermo who fought the mob in Sicily quite successfully. He said state and society are like two wheels on the cart, and they both need to turn for the cart to move forward. And I thought, it's the most beautiful metaphor. You absolutely need both parts to work, and an active citizenry is what keeps government functioning positively, but it's also what keeps government in check.
And so there are many ways that citizens do protest and do watchdogging and so on, and some of them are more effective than others. What are some things you've seen, some mistakes that activists make, and some really more effective techniques?
Sure. So in the book, I tell the story of the civil rights movement in America, because that's one of the most effective efforts to overturn institutionalized violence that any country has had. The level of violence in the U.S. South was quite high in the early part of the century, and then even as lynchings became less popular, they went up again after Brown versus Board of Education. You got another wave of violence in reaction to Brown versus Board and the thought that segregation might end. And so the civil rights movement had to fight immense violence, and they learned a lot of the lessons that work. And I'm afraid we've forgotten them in more recent protests. So one thing they learned is that you need to appeal to the middle class. Right now, there's this thought that the politics of respectability, as they call it, is bad, that basically you should be able to do what you want to do. You shouldn't have to appeal to middle class values. But the reality is the middle class is the voting public, and so you do need to. And the civil rights movement was very smart about how they did that, the imagery they used, the symbolism they used, to be non-threatening to the middle class. They needed to work with unlikely allies. They needed a broad, broad coalition. There's a great book by an academic at the University of Denver, Erica Chenoweth, on social movements and how they fought violence in all countries since 1900, I believe. And nonviolent social movements have immense success if they're broad-based. And that's because in these countries, they're all very polarized. And if you pick a topic and a way of framing an issue that just falls into that polarized discussion that seems very partisan, I mean, take our gun debate right now. You're for guns or you're against guns. Well, you're never going to win the debate if you posit something like that. You need a way of framing an issue that gets much more of the public across the partisan divide behind you. And so in Colombia, for instance, where they were polarized, are you for the guerrillas or are you for the paramilitaries? And the left wing was for the guerrillas because how else were they going to get social reform and justice for the poor? And the right was for the paramilitaries because the guerrillas were raping and pillaging and kidnapping kids and doing horrible things in the countryside. You weren't going to break that kind of hardened feeling. So the way around it was a social organizer said, let's have a referendum that we need a new constitution. Can we all agree that our government is broken? It can't fight. It can't keep us safe. It can't make our economy work. Well, everyone could agree on that. That was not a partisan issue. And that new constitution enshrined a lot of changes that allowed independents to run and so on. So the social movements have to avoid being partisan, and they have to avoid falling into those partisan polarized debates while being political. And this was the final thing that I found that was so interesting, was that we're so used to denigrating politicians in our democracy. And in these democracies, they really denigrate the politicians. The politicians might well be murderers. They're definitely often corrupt. It's very easy to say these are bad people. But you need good politicians to run a democracy. And so the social movements had to partner with politicians if they were going to make change. If they couldn't partner with a politician, they could protest all they wanted, but someone was going to have the power, and it wasn't going to be someone who shared their agenda. And so I talk about how civil rights movement leaders partnered with Lyndon Johnson. He wasn't a natural fit. Lyndon Johnson in the Senate had blocked every single form of anti-lynching law, of civil rights law. He'd criticized Harry Truman when Harry Truman desegregated the military. He was not a pro-civil rights senator by any stretch of the imagination. He was a senator from Texas. And to imagine that he would be your ally, I mean, it would be like partnering with Jesse Helms right now for someone on the very far progressive resist front. You know, it's sort of a crazy thought. And then when they did partner with him, LBJ was prosecuting the Vietnam War, which was massively unpopular. And so the civil rights campaigners had to separate those issues and say, look, we're going to win on the civil rights movement. Then we'll get to the war. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's be willing to work with this guy who's willing to work with us. And so it took a lot of pragmatism on the part of the politicians and the social movement leaders to actually make change.
And that's something else that I think is really important, is that we can't expect purity or perfection from our elected officials. they're living in a world where they, first of all, have to please so many people, and they have to be continually making deals with one another. And that's just not, it's not a world in which you can be an ideological purist, even if you want to be.
That's right. But I think we've sort of forgotten now, in this world in which we want our politicians to represent our id, you know, our core identity, we want them to be activists. But that's not the job of a politician in a democracy. You know, I look at my own family. I have two little girls and a husband. And if the four of us can agree on where to go for dinner, it's a big win, right? I mean, people have different views. And politicians have to, in a democracy, sort those views and find a way to come to compromise. We don't like that kind of politician today. But that's their job. And we need to respect that job in a democracy and allow them to do it. Otherwise, it won't. The democracy itself won't function.
As I was reading your book, I kept thinking about all the sloganeering about how government is the problem. Ronald Reagan famously said that. And we need smaller government, which is something you hear all the time, and continual tax cuts. And it seems like that ideology, the more it's implemented, the more it puts us in danger of having a weak state. There's not enough money then for schools. There's not enough money for police training. And there's not enough money for the judiciary and all these kind of things. And that, in turn, can lead to more violence. Do you think that we're seeing this process in the United States currently?
So I think when Ronald Reagan made his points, I mean, Ronald Reagan would be considered a flaming liberal today. When he made his points, the top tax rate was about 75%. That's really high. It made sense to say, look, let's bring down taxes when your top tax rate is 75%. That is not the case today. It is much, much, much lower. And you have to have balance. You know, a lot of this book is sort of a pay on to balance, which is hard for people to get behind. But there's a point at which government might be too big for people in America, but there's certainly a point at which it's too small. I tell my libertarian friends, if you really want a place with no government, go to Somalia.
Right.
I grew up in Alaska, which famously has very low government in some of its villages and so on. But it is a massive governmently subsidized state. That whole state functions on government handouts from the federal government. And so they like to imagine themselves as kind of free frontiers people. But there's a lot of government that makes Alaska work. And you know, when they get goods out to rural villages, that's the government helping make that happen. You need government, and you don't necessarily need it to be huge, but you need it to function. And so one of the things that I saw in this book was that as you denigrate government and you denigrate politicians, you break your democracy. And it's really important not to do that, to realize that there's a role for government to play. Am I worried about this in America right now? Yes and no. We are at a historic low point in violence right now. If you took out the four most violent cities in America, New Orleans, Baltimore, St. Louis, and Detroit, we would be at rates at the 1950s. And that's amazing to have that kind of low violence. However, we have all the criteria for it to start creeping up. We are underfunding our government services. Our police need more money. They need more training. They need more help. If you're going to police a very violent country with a lot of guns on the street, your police are doing a very dangerous job, and they need help doing that. We are at risk of losing trust in government and in our fellow citizens in a dangerous way. There's a man named Randy Roth who wrote a book called American Homicide, where he traced homicide in America from the founding to the present, and he found that violence goes up in America when two things occur. When people lose trust in government and say that they think most people in government are crooked, or they don't trust their politicians, and when they lose trust in one another, when fellow citizen ties fray. And we're certainly gaining on both of those variables. So that would suggest to me that things like the synagogue shootings, the school shootings, the pipe bombings, this kind of violence, we're much more likely to see more of it if we can't come together as a citizenry and heal some of those wounds we've got.
And as you write about, polarized societies are much less stable than unpolarized societies. And I think we were a less polarized society probably 50 years ago in many ways. And we've become politically polarized with the kind of polarization of the news media and the 24-hour news cycle and all of that. What do you think is our path forward?
So we are one of these countries that's been through privileged violence. We had this incredibly violent South and an incredibly violent civil war and violence against a portion of our citizenry that continues. And so all of the countries that came out of that and that got better, and I say that the U.S. is one that got better, they're like broken vases. You can see where they've been pasted back together. A politician who wants to can push on those fissures and break the thing again. It's very easy to do. They're much more fragile afterward, even if they get better. We're in that kind of a state in America right now. And I think for Americans to find a way back together requires more than just holding hands and saying kumbaya. It really requires us to think about what is the nature of the American government, what do we want it to do, how can it do it well, and enable that again.
I mean, it's a little scary because when you talk about the South, the American South during Reconstruction and afterwards in the Jim Crow South, you had a situation where, exactly as you said, this group knew it couldn't get elected if they had real democracy. And we see the assault on voting rights today, and it looks a lot like that in many ways, with so many voters being disenfranchised.
Right. So I think we shouldn't be complacent, but we also shouldn't overreact, because it's in that middle ground that we can actually make the most headway. America now is nothing like the level of violence of the 60s and 70s. When you look just at the numbers, we were having bombings nightly in some cities in the 60s, late 60s and 70s. Terrorist attacks were much, much higher than homicide numbers, sky high. We are a much, much more peaceful society than we had terrorist groups and vigilante groups from the left and the right in the late 60s and 70s. We were just a much, much more violent society, polarized because of civil rights, polarized because of the Vietnam War. We are a much more polarized society in certain ways, not along the partisan identity lines back then, because there were still a lot of Southern Democrats and liberal Republicans, but along every other line. So we are much, much less violent today than we were in 1971. And that means we have further to go. We have more breathing room. But are we on a bad trajectory? Absolutely. You're right that we are highly polarized along partisan lines, along ethnic lines, and along geographic lines right now. That's not good. And we are seeing the rise again of voting suppression. Now, one of the sad facts of the book is that if you can suppress voting peacefully, you don't need to do it violently. And so a lot of the Jim Crow South, a lot of those years were fairly peaceful because they had picked their electorate. You know, the politicians picked their electorate instead of the other way around. And by doing that, by disenfranchising so many people, they didn't need to use violence. I don't think America should go that way again, but I also don't want us to be violent. What I want to see is an America that realizes we have better angels. We're built of better stuff than what the leaders are pulling out of us right now.
What do you think is the role of women in building more stable and peaceful societies?
So I get this question every time I talk about the book, and it's really interesting to me that people have such an important gender lens on this. There's a lot of research that says that having women at the table during peace deals makes the peace stick longer, that makes it a much stronger. And I'm sure that that's true, but the research is flawed. The research is looking at correlation, not causation. So if a woman gets to a peace deal table in the first place, there's probably a reason for that, and it might be that the negotiators have more leverage vis-a-vis the rebel groups or what have you. So women in society can play both sides. You see violent societies where women are in control, like Bangladesh, where two women have been handing power back and forth for well over a decade, and it's an incredibly violent society because the women are not very nice women. But women can play a strong role in the social organizing, as politicians, in all of these roles. And you see them doing that. You see women in the social movement world playing extremely strong roles, trying to bring society together. In political roles, it could be harder. It's harder for women to serve in those positions in many countries that are more patriarchal. But where they decide to lead for more justice, they certainly can. So I think women and violence against women is also a canary in a coal mine here. Women and journalists both play this role of where you start seeing violence rising against them, you're likely to see it in the rest of society.
Is there an end game? In other words, is it ever possible, do you think, to reach long-lasting stability and peace? Or are we caught up in kind of cycles of history that tend to repeat in predictable ways, sort of dramas of violence, then peace followed by more violence?
One of the point of this book is that places can get better. Places can get a lot better. Places like Colombia, where murder rates were 80 per 100,000, can get to a place where murder rates are 24 per 100,000. That's still very, very high. But that's a huge number of lives that have been saved. That's a huge number of people who will get to know their grandparents. It makes a big difference. And so these places are not perfect. They're going to have higher levels of violence than a place that has never fallen into this kind of privileged violence. But to say that they're not perfect doesn't mean that they can't be hugely better and that that cycle can't last. It's always more fragile. It's always more liable for bad politicians to press on the fissures and cause polarization again. But the citizenry doesn't have to fall into that. There's no necessary reason why they have to fall for it again. And so these are stories in which human agency plays a big, big role. Nothing is inevitable in these stories. It might be that you're weaker, it might be that you're more debilitated as a country, but you can always move forward.
Rachel Kleinfeld is author of the book A Savage Order: How the World's Deadliest Countries Can Forge a Path to Security. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, such a privilege. Thank you.
And once again, Rachel Kleinfeld will be speaking about the book on Thursday, February 7th at 5:30 at the Hotel Santa Fe in the Hacienda Room. I will be in conversation with the author, and there will be a book signing. For more information, sfcir.org. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.